title has changed a bit. It's now called Impressive, that's the same, but then it's Memory, Matter and Mind. And I will start with a brief outline telling you what I'm intending to talk about. I really very much enjoyed Jana Herwig's talk, I have to say, again. And there is one point that I want to make where my whole approach and my attitude differs. If you remember her first slide, she didn't really point it out, but on the top right and on the top left, there was matter and mind, and there were question marks together with this, which indicated to me, which she actually stated after in reply to my question, that she is really experimenting with those categories. They are not exclusive, and they might be helpful to enlighten some things. Now, as a philosopher, I'm more committed to taking these categories seriously, which will not mean that I keep them rigorously apart, but as a working hypothesis, I will start with a reasonable, stable understanding of those categories, namely matter as in materialism, scientific undertakings, some objective investigations, and on the other hand, mind as in consciousness, fantasy, ideas, and things like that. And my first two sections will be matters of memory and minding the matters of memory, and then only in the third section I will talk about trying to mediate some of the dualisms that I will show you. Now, why do I talk about memory? It is because this section is on archives, and the overall subject of the conference is mind and matter, and I thought it might be the right way to approach this, to talk about memory, which after all is an underlying condition and phenomenon beneath the phenomenon of the second or third level cultural institution like an archive. And that, as it happens, when I was invited to give this talk, I was reading a book that you might have heard of, and my first section will start with this book and will not be in any way original. It will be trying to put in front of you some of the evidence that science, and in particular molecular biology, has assembled as far as investigating the biological foundations of memory are concerned. Erich Kandel, as you might know, has written this book In Search of Memory. He is born in Vienna, but was forced to leave Vienna in 1938. And went off to the United States to be one of the most prominent promoters of molecular biology, in particular with regard to investigating memory. And he received the Nobel Prize in 2000, I think, for his investigation. And in his book, he is talking, he starts, it's a nice twist, he starts in memorizing, in giving us how his memories of Vienna and the sort of exile and the situation that was of course forcing Jews like him to leave Austria, and then he gradually leads over to his scientific endeavors of memory, only to, in the end, come back to those more general, more personal memories of Vienna. Now, here I give you one figure which captures in some way the exciting and breakthrough moment that Kendall is associated with investigating what he calls correlates of some sort of tracing, archiving, memorizing living beings. And this breakthrough came when, with the advances of neurophysiology the miniaturization of the equipment, it was possible in the 60s, 70s to go down to the level of an individual neuron and to trace the firings and the operation, the whole operational modus of particular neurons. And he picked, as an animal to study these developments, he picked a snail, a marine snail called Aplysia, I guess in English, which is very convenient because it has a comparatively huge axon in its neurons, so it is easy to work with electrodes here. And what he did, this was the basis of his research on sort of memory, is he studied a particular mechanism in this snail, which if you describe it on the surface, is there is a siphon where water flows into this animal, and when you touch the siphon, there is a reflex, and this reflex causes the gill on the animal to contract. And he was able to show, to follow all these neurons, these single neurons that lead from the siphon to the ganglion within this nervous system of this animal, and to trace those impulses, the stimuli from the sensory neurons, to trace them to their connection with the motor neurons, the motor neurons causing the gill to contract. And this is, of course, a chemical story, and I'll show you some more pictures to give you the general idea of how this is has turned out. Now, the neurons, as you will know, build a very complicated web of interconnections, and the most important part, one of the most important parts, of course, is the synapses. The synapses are those intermediary spaces between dendrites and axons. These are the spaces where information gets exchanged between electrical impulses coming from the dendrites of a certain neuron impacting on the presynaptic part of the neuron and emitting certain substances into the synapse, which on the other hand are received and taken up by the other neuron, and in particular, here you get the sensory neuron, which has an active terminal here, and this active terminal is able to emit chemical substances that have an effect on the motor neuron. Now, this is poor neurophysiology. How is this even approaching to address the matter of memory. Now, the reason is this, that in the experimental design of Kendall, he used the behavioral paradigm from Pavlov to experiment, to try and experiment with habituation and sensitization. Sensitization comes about when you keep addressing and you keep stimulating. Thank you. You keep stimulating the organism, and because of this constant stimulation, there is a lot more going on within the neurons as if there is nothing going on. As you see here, there is a certain general setting that you are born with. There is a certain pattern that the neurons of a newborn child or an evolving child are in general arranged, but that is not enough. They have to be activated to find their own particular connections. And as Kendall was able to show, if the sensory neuron is activated in a particular way, it will actually develop, grow new active terminals. It will be a strengthening of particular synapses connecting those neurons. I will not really go into details here, first of all, because I can only read these words to you. I have no deep chemical knowledge so that I cannot explain to you how this is really going to work. But I do feel it's important, if you talk about memory within the framework of matter and mind, to keep in mind that something like this is the state of the art of the scientific investigations in these matters. So here you get a scheme, a very simplified scheme of the siphon and the gill. Here you get the tail of the aplasia, and what it shows you here is that that the sensory neuron is, when it is stimulated, emitting by now a fairly well-investigated chain of reaction of chemical components, and these and then an interesting next step is the following: it's not just emitting those chemical components. There is a correlation between what is usually called short-term memory and long-term memory. We know about the difference between short-term and long-term memory from cognitive psychological investigations. We also know that if there is a certain deficiency in the brain, or if there is an accident, the brain is damaged or something, it might be the case that you have a short time memory, but you are unable to remember what has been going on 2 hours ago. So it is clear that there are different mechanisms involved, and one of important differences that I want to tell you about, because this was new to me and I thought it might interest you too. This difference between short-term and long-term memory actually has a very clear pendant in the biochemistry of memory, namely short-term memory amounts to a strengthening of the synapses that are involved by means of chemical transmitters that are released into the synapses, but they vanish. They vanish once the impulse is gone. And in order to be preserved, there has to be a different mechanism in place. And this different mechanism actually involves the production of protein for which the nucleus of the respective neurons is responsible. So that means that if it is important enough, it is strong enough, if it goes on long enough, our memory is turned from short-term memory to long-term memory by actually genetic additional genetic production within our brain. And this genetic production that produces the additional terminals, so to speak, here. And the scientific breakthrough really that he was awarded the Nobel Prize for was really to decipher all the chemical intricacies and details of how the sensitive apparatus, the touch that goes via the skin, via the sensory neurons into the neural system, how this actually produces long-lasting, semi-permanent, additional synaptic, neuronic growth. So just to show you a nice picture, this is how the whole enterprise has been presented by Lee and Kendall himself. I'll also show this because it's an open access contribution to Biomed Central. This is something that I'm quite interested in, quite a lot of research in biology, in medicine is closed and has to be paid for. This in particular is a very long review article about what's going on. You see here is the shock, and it is giving you all the chemical compounds that are involved here. When I read this, and it is described down there, how this is really going to happen, it seemed to me that this is really an aside. It is, in some way, it is not... completely dissimilar to the Habsburg tree of genealogy, for example, some very complicated dynastic pattern or something like this. The story of how Marie Theresa and Joseph and Leopold and Ferdinand and whoever one can imagine that this is archived some way, probably in the Kunsthistorische Museum. And here you have the sort of mechanism and the story that goes with it. It's only in chemistry, not in genealogy. Now, I told you more or less about this, so I'll skip, I'll move on to my second part. I think it's uncontroversial that what I have showed you here is observing the neural circuitry of an animal, which is a standard procedure of science, and which arrives at, to summarize this, it arrives at the details of a biochemical mechanism which has to be in place in order for memories to be developed. I could, of course, have shown you many more convincing and also dealing about human beings' observations here, it is quite clear that what we need to have within our brain in order to be able to build up memories is something like this. Something like this. This or extensions of this are going to have to be present in the brain, and it is easy from here to claim something like memory is this sort of strengthening of the synapses, because if the synapses are damaged, if this is not successful, memory is gone. There will be no memory. A very well-known example is Alzheimer's, where it has been shown that deficiency in the synaptic transmission of signals is the cause of the inability of patients to remember anything. Now, my second point, namely minding memory, is not observing the neural circuitry of an animal, but on the other hand, observe as an animal using the neural circuitry. And those animals include you and me, so we are the animals now. And I've set up an experiment to show you. Just a little help. These are the two patterns that get changed here. There are several of those films. One, a third one. These are the patterns here. Now, if I stop at this particular point and ask you about your capacities to understand this, about memory formation, I can do a lot of experimental works in cognitive psychology, like how many of you are able to find out which patterns. It's, for example, it's a quite important observation, even so it is a matter of fact, that I guess every one of us is not just confused, but is recognizing patterns under a different light, for example. With a given a certain movement, there are similar patterns. We are able to recognize those patterns. We could talk about the pattern exchange. We could investigate how many patterns are we able to recognize, under which conditions, things like that. And it would be comparatively easy, given contemporary technologies and techniques, or perhaps in 20 years' time or 10 years' time, even today it's possible, of course, to do this under some recording device which shows the images of your brain when you look at this, and which shows that certain areas of your brain will only respond to certain impulses that you have here. So you can set up a certain correlation between those inputs and what can be seen as going on in your brain. Now I'll give you here a fourth clip of the film that I'm using here. Hopla. There has been going on something funny here. Something interesting has been going on here. I trust you recognized that there is certainly a different type of image that came up, and it's this sort of image. And this sort of image is. I'll show you. Should I show you again? Just. Now, I, up to now, introduced this as a sort of a psychological experiment in a cage or something. If this was were the case, one could test attendance, one could test people's reaction to the difference between those two types of images. As you have seen, the type of image that's given here has a different, is connected with a different treatment of black, of dark and light, because there is this sort of darkness coming from the right right up angle and laying itself on the rest of the patterns. There is also not the on-off light and dark pulse. It is a different type of image, a different treatment of image. The pattern seems to be different than those patterns. As a test animal, as a psychological test animal, it might strike you that it is interesting. Why do they do this? What is behind all of this? But it is still on a level where there is no meaning here. The whole enterprise is to find out about your neurological setup and how you react as a conscious being. Now, I have been cheating in showing you these pictures as a sort of psychological experiment. There might be someone here who has already seen those pictures. Those pictures are taken from a movie from Kurt Cren. Kurt Cren is one of the best, a well-known Austrian experimental filmmaker from the 60s, 70s, 80s. And I've taken those from a movie that's called, it's made in 61. It's called Mauern, Positive, Negative und Weg. It's a movie of 6 minutes, which I didn't want to show you. I really recommend you to look at these Cren movies. They are, have been reissued by Index, by Sixpack Films. You can easily get them. They are really tremendously interesting and impressive. Now, what happens? When I was sitting looking at those, I'm making this up, but the story go one story could go as the following one. I'm sitting here. I'm looking at these patterns. I'm looking at those patterns that are on off, and then suddenly I see these patterns, and suddenly I remember, this movie was called Mauern and Path. Mauern und Weg, hoppla, he is actually contraposing those two different types of images, because these are obviously passes. This is the Weg, and this, as it turns out, are details from a wall. All of these details that you have seen are cut out from photographs of a wall. Now, once you have made this jump, there immediately comes a whole lot of additional ideas to your mind. Namely, there is between a wall and a path, there is a contradiction. A path is breaking out of being walled in. Now, the black and white that is connected, the on-off black and white that is connected with the wall, is contraposited to the shadows falling onto the way. Suddenly you see, if you look again and again, you see that there are actually humans crossing those paths. So this is only to indicate that with a certain jump of ideas, with a certain recognition of a change of patterns, there is actually change of recognition actually makes all the difference between an experimental situation like in the lab, in the psychology lab, and a lecture I could give at the Institute for Theatre, Film and Media Studies. Now this is the meaning of my minding matter. We can draw a line from patterns, sensual patterns, to the more elaborate theories on avant-garde Viennese film in the 60s of the last centuries, of the last century. And the question that I want to raise, of course, you will have gathered something like this, or the point I want to make is that even so, this starts with a situation where you have a fairly normal correlation between stimulating your visual system and having a consciousness of being stimulated like this. At a certain point, the ideas generated, what's happening when you are listening, looking at this, listening to someone who talks about this, is going out of control, so to speak, which in some way raises, of course, the question, what is the correlate of this sort of hermeneutical avant-garde film theory that I have started to present you. What's the correlate of this in the nervous system? Now, to what I did here is switching, showing you how it is possible to switch from lack of meaning to the abundance of meaning if you you regard the mind and the consciousness of stimulation as something on its own that certain animals do have and make use of. Now, I have brought certain excerpts from a second movie of Kurt Cren, which is called Keine Donau. That's another great movie of his, which I cannot show in its entirety. I quote this here. I'll present it to you because it, in some way, moves a different direction. It moves from established meanings towards the deconstruction of meaning, towards memory loss, if you want. And the point I want to make is that you can, once you discuss and you investigate matters of the mind that goes with a movie show like this, you can also lose yourself and lose meaning, not just suddenly build up an enormous amount of meaningful connections. How does this work? This is the one and only film shot that Kurt Cran uses for this movie. I have to say, you probably already saw it with those passes, that his particular technology that he uses quite often in his films is to use the same film several times, superimpose images of the same situation onto the same film with the static camera, which will show you the same general pattern and outline, because this is fixed. But since the film is going through the camera several times, there will be certain unusual effects that can be discovered. To start the easy way, it will be like this. So this is fairly unproblematic. You can even so it's a movie, you can feel like you're looking at a photo. Graph, you might worry if it's your eyesight that is a bit deficient, or whether the film has not been shot in the right way. But basically, it's an enforcement of what you know, what you are offered to. To receive, to sort of process, namely a backyard, one particular backyard in Vienna. Now, the second clip that I show you already throws some of this into disarray. In particular, look at what's going here on here at the balcony. There are traces of several films put into one, superimposed onto one another. There is snow. Again, the woman is gone. Instead of this, there is a lamp there. Here again, the snow is gone. And now here again you have another lineup of clothes at the balcony. I'll show you this last clip. No, that was not. Yeah, you got the. Okay, I can tell you, looking at this for the first time, also the second time, sitting through this for 8 minutes, it was a sort of a nuisance. It seemed to be a bit boring because this is all you see for 8 minutes, and this is not quite the rhythm that one is accustomed to nowadays. But I can tell you from my experience, the more I looked into it, the more fascinating this became. And after looking at it for the fifth or sixth time, I started to discover new things every time. What I want to point out here is that suddenly what you look at, these patterns, they are not important as photos or films in any way. In some way, you are almost pushed into a situation where you might think that it's just your own fantasy. It's your memories. It's some way. It's your neurons gone wild. It's not important, and it's not very plausible initially that this is going to happen. That this is in some way had happened. It might be just as well if you were under the influence of some substance, where you feel that. Clear contours dissolve. The more important thing is that things are going on by themselves. You lose your connection to reality. You use any urge to put some particular meaning on any of those shapes. Now, these were my two experimental settings. The one setting biochemical neural pathways, and the other one cascading meaning proliferation. And now here I come to my third part, mediation. And of course, in some way, the question has to be asked, how do these two experiments relate to each other? How can we talk about the relationship between mind and matter? This is what I warned you about, that I am going to approach these issues as a traditional philosopher in some way, and to throw in one name that you will have heard, and which is quite two names actually that you might have heard and that are helpful for my who's been quite well known for writing about these issues from a neurologist, but also from lay philosopher. This quote is taken from a book, Looking for Spinoza, and Spinoza is the second name. Spinoza, 17th century Dutch philosopher, who is, amongst other things, well known for the following answer to the question I've been posing, namely concerning the relationship between matter and mind. To put it in Damasio's words, that mind and body are parallel and mutually correlated processes, mimicking each other at every crossroad as two faces of the same thing. So with good, it's a so-called two aspects views. There is something down there on the basis of it, and you look at it in two different ways, and those two different ways are two ways of looking at the same thing. One is the mind view, and the other one is the matter view. And another quote from Damasio, points out that in Spinoza, mind processes, the matter part of this duality, mind processes are taken to be more important, the mind has the matter has to work in the appropriate way in order to give rise for mind. But then on the other hand, and this is something I like very much in this quote, on the other hand, the ideas in the mind can double up on each other, something that bodies cannot do. This is what I was referring to when I said there is this explosion of meanings. Once you got one idea, this one idea concerning the wall and the pathways through the forest, once you got this idea, in an instant there will be many more ideas just coming in for free, and that's not something you get in this particular way in matter. Of course, you can have cancer. In some way, a cancer cell is matter doubling up on matter, running out of control. You can, of course, also have matter running out of control in some way, but this this doesn't touch on my point here. Now, here I have a slide which will probably not be of such great interest to you, but it is to me as a philosopher trying to figure out how to deal with this particular type of situation. So I'll just throw it in and mark it as the systematic place where an answer could be found. The matching of those two perspectives, of course, is the crucial issue. And in traditional thinking, there are certain prototypical solutions to this question. You get dualism, you get monism, you get reductionism, you get epiphenomenalism, emergentism, different ways to reconcile or to abolish the question of how do mind and matter relate. Now, the solution towards which I have been working, to which I want to point you, is the following. Given that we have this two aspects approach Spinoza has started, we can say something like the following. We can say, once we introduce two ways of looking at things, then we will have a reason to introduce this. We better have a reason to introduce a double aspect view. And what is the reason? Well, the reason is we can make sense of it. We can use it. We can profit from introducing those two different approaches. I give you three examples of correlating two aspects which we clearly have a use for. For example, pieces of paper and money. What are the typical questions in matter and mind discussion is we cannot have mind without matter. So isn't it the case that mind goes before matter? Matter goes before mind. One can always look at it both ways. Now, a very similar argument can be made. We cannot have money in some restricted way, I have to concede. We cannot have money without anything to hold on to. It's a coin, or it's a piece of paper, or it's a credit card, or it is an entry in a database. If it's not in some way materialized, it's gone. It cannot be claimed as money. And at the same, so you have to have a material foundation for that. But this doesn't mean that the material foundation is money. Money is a second way of looking at this. And it is a way of looking at this which is cleverly correlated with the needs of a social group, namely particular under particular rules, particular pieces of particular paper have to be used to be able to be seen as money. And you can do the same story with black colored things and mourning, and you can do the same thing with siren sounds and danger. These are convenient combinations of dual aspects in order to achieve certain aims. And the same goes with mind and matter. This is because, for example, we want Alzheimer to be cured. We come up with these convenient two ways of looking at things, and we are able to profit from this. I have written at the end of the slide up to a certain point. There is this correlation, and it is useful and it is helpful, but it breaks down in certain instances. I mentioned cancer. Cancer would be a nice idea unless a cure is found and unless cancer is completely eradicated. We have this situation when part of your body runs amok and destroys you, even so you try as good as you can to come up with new medicaments to stop the body running away from you. This is clearly a case where those the internal law, the internal regulations of those two different aspects cannot be reconciled. My concluding last section will be a jump again, and I will work towards my own interpretation of paraflows. You will be interested to know, and I'll start with something. And my general aim is to in this last section not start with dualism, but show that dualism is something we impose on the situation for our own purposes. But we are not forced to do this. If you look at these pictures, they might come from another Kurt Cren movie, and I could do the same psychological experiment type that I'd done before. And if you look at this clip here, again, it might be a Kurt Cren movie. But again, I have cheated here because this time it's not a Kurt Cren movie at all. It's taken from a TV series, a Homicide of I don't know which who did produce this, and I'll show you part of this what's going on here. No, it's not. This is not so true. It's not necessary. Okay, when I, it's not as important. Now, when I saw this in preparing for this talk, I said to myself, look, these sequences here, they are pretty much experimental cinema. You only have to boost them a bit. All the stuff I told you about sensual systems and stimuli and being able to deal with certain visual impulses, all this stuff is to be found in there. I would risk the guess that no one, this has been broadcast, I think, in 95 or something. I don't think that during the last 15 years anyone used this type of, this particular sequence to show that a sort of confusing, unclear, flowing, discontinuous, sensual visual impressions are part of mainstream entertainment media. And this goes to show that we are perfectly able, within our ordinary, everyday consuming of media, to include and to incorporate these sort of phenomena without applying the analysis that I have showed you. In some way, it is part of our dealing with the world. We do not, and the reason I say this is that we do not have, in order to deal with this, we do not have to analyze it into mind and matter and into split second photographs that are reassembled afterwards. They are part of a flow that we are perfectly able to cope with and to deal with. And now the last example that I want to show you, and this is because I sometimes I like to look at soccer in TV. This is a snapshot from Belgium against Germany 10 days ago or something, and you have a situation like this. The white shirts are the Germans. You can look at it like a piece of chess. You can ask yourself, what is going on here? What are the next moves? You can have the visual impression of what's going on here. And this is a very clear-cut visual impression of two teams opposing each other with the ball here. And this is what you get if you freeze, the frame. Now I show you what went on afterwards. I really have to say, it is a touch of genius. There is no other way to describe it. The pass of Thomas Müller, it's just a touch of genius. Look at that. Here. And he doesn't even look. And once again. Now the point with which I want to end, and it's coming back to memory. One way to approach it is you've seen four different renderings of this particular incident. There is just no way. There's absolutely no way that without a particular memory and an understanding of what's going on, you can re-identify those four different settings. I'll come back to this in the end. This is the first point. The second point is if you have a neural image of this situation, there will be, I will not hesitate, a mathematical estimate, but there are very, very many things that can follow up here, that can follow from a situation like this. Now, never ever was there a situation like this? This is unique in the universe. In the whole universe, this is a unique situation in this particular minute, at this particular game. And in this particular situation, Thomas Müller had an idea of a genius. And it was not written into his memory system. It was not written in his sensory system. It is a different kind of question. I do in no way, of course, deny that all of this can only go on if he has a body and has a nervous system and all of this. But there is no precedent. There is absolutely no precedent for the fact that he was able to pass, to find out in his understanding of the game, to find out the game is moving like this. If he plays the ball from here to here, then Miroslav Klose will be able to score a goal. Now, the last point about patterns and comparison. If you are given this as a sort of advanced geometry, find out which pictures show a similar situation. It will be comparatively easy to see that this situation is precisely the same situation that's going on here, looked at from a different angle. Even so, I mean, I could have I now realized to be even more precise, I would have had to check the timestamp here, and this situation is the same like this situation. There's a little shift here, but keep in mind that you are recognizing this in no time at all in the half a minute that is involved here. You see four of those different patterns, and those different patterns can be identified by you as being from the same basic situation. And so this is my last slide, and this is now referring to paraflows. It has to be said that there is no word as paraflow. I haven't asked. I will certainly be informed now, but I think it's been created by Grenzfurtner, Friesinger and co. It is, in my understanding, an attempt to combine movement, flow, and para, sideways, like para psychology, paranoia, paramedic. And it means, in my interpretation, it means not being in the grip of snapshots, being in the grip of pattern matching retrospectively. It means it has to do with something with go with the flow. Immerse yourself in flowing, but also drifting sideways. This is what I wanted to recall in my last section. I conclude with a remark which is directed against paraflows and for scientific investigations, and so comes back to where I started. To begin is to start at some point in time, like those photos I've showed you, those figures that I showed you. This is also the start of scientific investigation of memory, and there is null flow here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Herbert Rachowitz. Questions?
Yes. You told us that Spinoza had the theory that mind and matter are a kind of duality within one thing, like a double face. This statement is, as you also know, a philosophically and epistemologically very, very critical statement. Because if you state that mind and matter are two aspects of one thing, this statement itself is not belonging to the duality of mind and matter, but it belongs to a kind of meta mind, which is handling linguistically and in a kind of new concepts the duality of mind and matter. And so what I want to point out is that Spinoza's thesis cannot be the last answer. Of course, if we are going down, if you want, to the modern kinds of philosophy, you find that also the duality, from the thesis of duality of mind and matter, becomes more and more changed by more and more trivial kinds of theories about mind and matter. But what I want to point out is that as far you are going also in postmodernistic theories of mind and matter, this point I mentioned before cannot be overcome. So I think that we have always and still today to point out that the question is not solved, and of course we can handle it in some pragmatic way, but we have to take into attention that the question is open.
Yeah, that was quite a wide array of questions. I agree with your basic points. Let me put it like this. I have a certain initial sympathy with Spinoza because of an empirical observation. For example, we think we know who Madonna is, and then we notice something strange, something she vanishes, sometimes she looks a little bit different, and then suddenly someone comes up with the theory, Madonna is at the same time Hillary Clinton or Glenn Close or something. So it might be the case. She might be leading a double life. To give a literary example, you know Dr. Jekyll, there are some dark sides here, and it turns out that at the same time he is Mr. Hyde. Now this is something that can happen empirically. And you start from observation at some level, and then you have a puzzle, and then you solve the puzzle by introducing the two aspect views. Now, if you do this, I completely agree with you, you jump one level up. So I agree with you with that, but it's not really problematical. In some way, it's what we're doing all the time. If I discover that Billa is not Billa anymore, but it belongs to Edeka, or part of Billa or something like this, with Billa there should really be Edeka because it belongs to Edeka, it is in some way a progression, a cognitive progression, but it is harmless. It is not in any way problematic to look at it both ways. If I look at a piece of paper and I suddenly realize it's Korean money, I actually have to have a mastery of what money they use in Korea and what this piece of paper is. So I can combine it. Now with Spinoza, in some way my sympathy is because he was able to point out, he was referring to this sort of experience to solve the problem of the relationship between mind and matter. Now, if you look at this problem as something solid ontologic, a solid ontological problem, then, and that, here I come back to what you've been pointing out about Singh, the very first basic problem you hit into is that Spinoza himself says there is one thing underlying the relationship between a thing and the consciousness of a thing. And now you have two occurrences of thing. You have the thing as vis-a-vis the mind, and then you have the underlying thing. And you have to explain in which way the thing underlying, the relationship between a thing and the consciousness, can be a thing. And then you are in trouble. I agree with you on that. And this is precisely, I'll stop in a minute, this is precisely why I introduced this construction of helpful correlations between two aspects that only that do help you, but only up to a certain point. After a certain point, things break down. Last point, with Spinoza, in the end, the one factor, the one piece that ensures his system to work is that for God, everything has those two aspects. So God is in possession of the complete translation table. He knows how those things relate. And if you are God, you can just point out this is this, what is this. If you are not God, it's bad for you.
So I was just it's very interesting actually, and it will take me a couple of months to understand everything that you have said. But I am reminded of the Advaita philosophy that has been existing in India for a couple of thousands of years, and the philosophy is of duality, but is of a duality of a different kind. It's about the mind and body and the illusion. So it considers the mind-body as one, but the second part of the duality is the illusion. And what I understand of it is that the mind exists because it sees itself as a projection on the matter. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is the duality, the illusion. And if you somehow are able to disjoint the mind from the matter, you're slowly able to dissolve the mind and release yourself from the illusion, then the thing that exists would only be flow. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I'll take this as a helpful suggestion. I cannot directly respond to it because I'm not really familiar with this sort, but I will be looking this up.
Thank you for this talk full of twists and turns and new perspectives, which is putting the person responding to it in the interesting position that at one point you said, well, we have those dualities and they can be helpful, but we don't have to use them, which means that in responding to the talk, responding to anything you said before that is sort of... and act in vain. But anyway, I'm going to pick up from one of the things you said, even though we don't have to take any of this serious. Because at one point, but that was before that, I think, okay, this is there he cheated again, but he didn't tell us this time that he cheated. And that was when suddenly your duality of matter and mind became that of matter and meaning. Mm-hmm. Yes. And then, sure, well, I just mentioned that here. I wouldn't be able to say whether it works this way, and anyway, the question marks on my slide simply meant that maybe somebody might be interested in mapping archive and repertoire with mind and matter, but but I'm not the person who would like to do this because I'm not sure whether it would be a fruitful experience. Okay, it's not really a question. That's just a remark that I noticed that you kept that quiet. And what I actually, but that was also before that point of revelation. What I'd like to point out is what when you said when you quoted Damasio, who referred to Spinoza, eyes in the mind can double up something that bodies cannot do. And I thought exactly what we saw then, what you assigned to movement, showed us that bodies can indeed double up. Even though I would not assign this to movement, but rather to movement and collective action and collective bodies.
Two very very precise, very good points. The first is I really was a bit negligent in jumping from mind to meaning. But the reason is first meaning is like matter, mind, and meaning. It's a nice M, it's a nice chain of M's. But also I think it can be argued for because I wanted to bring it. From introspection, one's particular mind to the experience and to the cultural factuality of community, because meaning, whereas mind is closely linked to brain. You have the brain, you've got the mind, and all and very much of the discussion of neural physiology, neural philosophy is concentrated on this single person brain and mind. In my mind, this is a wrong attitude, because the thing interesting, if you care for mind, is that minds can communicate.
And bodies.
And also bodies. Okay, yes. But that the communication of bodies and the communication of mind, they go through different rhythms. There are different rules there. Namely, you can. In dancing or in playing football, you have a communication of bodies, but this communication of bodies is different from understanding the difference between a wall and a path. This would have been too difficult for me, and so
I mean, or do you
I
mean
skipped it?
Or do
yes,
you mean I, like bodies?
I'm thinking about this. Yes. Yes, yeah. And your second point is related, is actually related to this. I was thinking about it, even though I didn't point it out, that the beauty of a football game is that it's a common activity. Bodies are involved, minds are involved, and you never, this was actually the reason I showed these pictures in the end, you never come up with the flow of this movie if you use brain images. If you use brain images of the particular players involved, this will just don't lead you anywhere. And the reason is because it is not something individual. It is a common social activity of a game, which goes the rules of which are to be investigated at a different level from instances of moves in a particular game.
Okay, more questions, more statements. It was quite interesting to see for me, because you have not seen the talk yesterday, but Karl Matschulis yesterday, he's a roboticist and he's researching in haptic devices, and he was proposing new forms of computer games based on biometrics and using your own body and like trying to click the mouse or tap the mouse when you hit your own heartbeat or stuff like that. So he's like in the interesting, the communication of like you play with your own body and what does that. I find that very interesting, and let's see what will happen there in the future, because I think there's a quite open field of the mind-body thing that might be interesting and stuff like that.